Hi, I'm Megan Gorman, author of All the President's Money, How the Men Who Governed America Governed Their Money. I've spent my career working with wealthy families in the United States, and I've learned a lot about the skills needed to build wealth. And what a better way to explore those skills, but by looking at our presidents and seeing who was very good at building wealth and who lacked the skills to succeed financially. Now, we think money dramas that we have today have never been seen before. But what we find with the presidents is despite different periods of time in American history, the money issues have always been the same. So today, I'm going to give you 5 insights from my book. And these key insights will give you some perspective on how to build wealth. And I'll even give you an insight that didn't make it into the final version of my book. Insight number 1. What creates financial harmony in a partnership? And here's a hint. Think about the Carters, not the Lincolns. Now, marrying up can be a good thing for personal finance, but just make sure that whoever you marry, you have similar values. Some of our most successful presidents have married women who have come from a higher socioeconomic status than they were from. The list is unbelievable. George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, Dwight Eisenhower, Lyndon Johnson, Bill Clinton, just to name a few. But keep in mind, it isn't all about the money. In personal finance, shared vision is key. For instance, Jimmy and Rosalind Carter didn't always see eye to eye on things, but they had grown up together and shared similar values. So in the early 1950s, when he decided at his father's death to move the family back to Georgia and abandon a very lucrative career in New York, Rosalind Carter was not happy at all. She wanted to stay in New York and have him continue as a nuclear engineer in the Navy. After all, they were saving about $75 a month and living a great lifestyle. But Jimmy was insistent. They were going to move back to Georgia and take over the family farm. Now, when they moved back to Georgia, it was not an easy transition. There was a lot of tension between Jimmy and Rosalind, but they stayed the course. They focused on building the farm together. And what Jimmy learned was that Rosalind was an amazing bookkeeper. In fact, if it wasn't for her, he probably would not have succeeded with the family farm as much. And this was a shared vision that they brought together and even carried the farm into their years in the White House. Now, in comparison, the Lincolns were a little bit more mismatched financially. While Abraham Lincoln grew up poor and went through a lot of experiences in both succeeding and failing with money, he understood that it was important to have a philosophy and to be a saver. In fact, he saved every part of his salary of his presidential paycheck during the war and invested it in treasury bonds and notes. In comparison, his wife Mary grew up very wealthy in a Kentucky household, and she would often spend time shopping in New York, and she would hide the bills from her husband Abe. In fact, during the Civil War, when he was up for re-election, she even shared with her dressmaker that she hoped he won because if he didn't, he would learn about all the debt she had racked up while he was president. Now, unfortunately for the Lincolns, their financial infidelities were never able to be fully resolved due to his assassination. And for the rest of her life, Mary struggled with money. Insight number 2. How to set yourself up for a lucrative retirement like Gerald Ford and every president who copied him afterwards. Now, for a large part of American history, presidents left office and either wrote a book, went back to practicing law, or just simply died. But one president changed the whole dynamic, and that is Gerry Ford. Now, Gerry Ford wasn't a president for a long time. In fact, he's often called the accidental president, as he succeeded Richard Nixon when he resigned. But when Ford lost the presidency to Jimmy Carter, he realized he had to figure out what he was going to do next. He was young, he was in his early 60s, and he didn't want to play golf every day. But Gerald Ford also knew he wanted to live a nice lifestyle, and he only had a couple of $100,000 saved. So what did he do? Well, he didn't call a financial advisor. Instead, he connected with a gentleman named Norman Brokaw, who was a talent agent at William Morris. And the two of them put together a retirement strategy. First, Jerry and his wife Betty signed the first First Lady and Presidential book deal for $1 million. Second, he decided he would travel the country and do speeches for organizations that he believed in. And finally, third, they created a category called entrepreneurial endeavors. And so Gerry Ford, who left the White House with just a couple $100,000 to his name, went off and embarked on the strategy. Now, I'm not going to get into all the entrepreneurial endeavors that he got into after the president, but I will tell you that Gerry Ford found that the best thing he could do post-presidency was serve on the board of publicly traded companies. And people like Sandy Weill of Smith Barney often spoke about the fact that Gerry Ford was so valuable to these companies because as a former president, he saw the world differently than everybody else. And Gerry Ford was incredibly successful in joining these boards. He often had his own specific contract negotiated out. And when he passed away in 2006, he clearly did well because his estate was estimated to be over $6 million. So the lesson here, have a retirement strategy. Insight number three, how to maximize paying for college, regardless of the era. Now, education funding has always been challenging across American history. In fact, 9 U.S. presidents did not have a college degree. But college was something that people really wanted to make sure that they could have access to. So one president had some unique strategies over the course of his life, and that president was John Adams. Now, John Adams wanted to go to college, and his father, who was also named John Adams, wanted him to go to Harvard. So John Adams studied diligently, took the exams for Harvard, and did so well that he even got a scholarship. But that scholarship wasn't enough for John Adams to pay fully for school. Now, we often think of our early presidents like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson as major landholders. But the Adams family of New England also held a lot of land. And one of their mantras was that land was the best investment and they should never sell it. But when John Adams got into college, his father made an exception and sold some land as a way to pay for his education. Now, fast forward, John Adams marries Abigail Adams, and their firstborn son is named John Quincy Adams. But they were in a much different situation when it was time to send John Quincy Adams to college. John Quincy Adams had accompanied his father around Europe during his diplomatic missions and had even gone to The Hague for a few years for university. So John and Abigail Adams cooked up an interesting plan in how they could get their son a Harvard education. They pitched Harvard on the fact that their son already had a few years of education under his belt, and that if he took the right examinations, he should matriculate at Harvard, but not as a freshman, but rather as a junior. Luckily for them, John Quincy Adams did very well in the education test on exams, got into Harvard, and his parents only had to pay for the last 2 years of his college education. And so how both Adams got through college really gives you an idea that it's not just about getting in, but it's having a strategy to get out with as little debt as possible. Insight number four, money anxiety impacts all of us. We often think that because they were presidents, they don't worry about money and that they were successful in everything they did. But to be honest, in going through the primary source documents, one thing is clear. Money anxiety is something that impacts all of us, even the presidents. Can you imagine the fact that John F. Kennedy worried about people taking advantage of him and his money? And that Lyndon Johnson would write a letter to friends in 1942, saying that he waked up at night worried about money, or that Harry Truman would correspond with his future bride, Bess, and complain how hard it was for a man to achieve the American dream. The feelings of anxiety is one that we can all navigate. However, I will tell you, some presidents navigated it better than others. For instance, Ronald Reagan came from a pretty poor background. His father was an alcoholic, and the family often had to escape their landlords in the middle of the night. But due to his mother and his girlfriend's father, Reagan learned an important skill, budgeting. And over the course of his life, whenever money was tight, Reagan relied on budgeting to help navigate his financial anxiety. So in the late 40s and early 50s, after his first divorce from Jane Wyman, Ronald Reagan was struggling in his career. He had been a B-list movie actor and, as a result, wasn't able to get the jobs he once had. He married Nancy Davis, and while they could afford a house, they couldn't afford the furniture yet. They had to budget strategically to get it. Lucky for Reagan, he was able to get Nancy to budget alongside him, and those are the skills that helped him navigate his financial anxiety. So always think about the fact that budgeting isn't really a nasty chore that we all have to do, but rather a really great way to manage our anxiety. Finally, insight number 5, how to align your charitable giving strategy with your intent. Now, over the course of history, presidents have been incredibly charitable. George Washington focused on providing education to young people who were orphaned. Millard Fillmore made sure that he was able to do charitable endeavors that supported his hometown of Buffalo. But there's one president who really changed what charity means in the United States, and that's no other than Franklin Delano Roosevelt, or FDR as we often call him. Now, FDR came for money, and when he was growing up, charity was something that really only the wealthy did. But in the early 1920s, he was afflicted with polio, and as he struggled to find a cure, he was able to engage in certain types of treatments that he found made a difference for him. One of those treatments was in being in Warm Springs, Georgia. And during his time there, Roosevelt decided to set up a charity, and he enlisted his business partner, Basil O'Connor, to help him. Now, at first, their charity was focused on helping others get therapeutic treatments. But ultimately, the charity evolved where they wanted to seek a cure for polio. And once FDR was president, he and O'Connor came up with an interesting idea. On the president's birthday, they would have birthday balls, and they would encourage every American to send in a dime. And in fact, singer Eddie Cantor called it the March of Dimes. But by all these Americans sending in dimes, they were able to grow the charity to put money to work for scientific research for a vaccine. And 10 years after FDR died in April of 1945, the cure to polio was found, and a vaccine was administered to all Americans, which ended up removing the threat of this horrible disease. And by doing this, FDR changed charity because he convinced us that even the smallest of donors can make a difference. So those are my 5 insights, and there are many more stories of the presidents and their money. So have a read of my book, see how many of these skills for wealth building you have compared to the presidents, and enjoy your financial journey. Thanks for having me on.